Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. Our contributing editor, Christopher P. Cavas, visited USS Gerald R. Ford at sea and joins us in a moment for an update on the Navy's drive to operationalize its newest game-changing aircraft carrier. But first, joining us is our producer, Chris Cervello, a retired U.S. Navy commander and public affairs officer, for his quick take on acting Defense Secretary Chris Miller's announcement on Tuesday of troop reductions in Afghanistan and Syria. On Tuesday, the man who replaced Dr. Mark Esper as defense secretary said that U.S. troops in Afghanistan would be cut from 4,500 to 2,500, even as the Taliban continue violence against Afghan forces and civilians, and U.S. troops would be cut from 3,000 to 2,500 in Iraq. The moves will be accomplished by January 15, and reporting indicates that that target has been set by President Trump, who is considering another run for president. He wants to be able to claim that he delivered on his campaign promise to withdraw from both operations and bring U.S. troops home. Chris, thanks very much for joining us, and I know we're going to be talking in greater detail about this on the Friday roundtable.
Thanks for having me, Vago.
And before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy. And Beretta USA is sponsoring our land warfare coverage. Chris, talk to us a little bit about this decision, right? It's almost universally being criticized for not being connected to actual events, right? That troops would be cut only if the Taliban, for example, agree to a comprehensive peace deal with our Afghan allies, thereby allowing U.S. and allied forces to draw down. Trump's capricious decision to unilaterally withdraw troops from Syria, abandoning our Kurdish allies, was why Jim Mattis resigned as defense secretary. What's the reaction to this? And moreover, what's Trump's calculus?
Well, it's unclear what the president's calculus is. I mean, I've heard folks describe it as one of three scenarios. One is that he's acting as if he won the election, and this is second term business, and he's just moving on as if he was going to be the president for a second term. I've heard people say that, you know, he's starting to accept, or the people around him are starting to accept defeat, and that they're trying very hard to finish unfinished business. They're looking to set up the incoming administration so that if Trump or a Trump ally run in 2024, they have something to immediately criticize the new administration on. And then I've had people, serious people, tell me they just think the president's trying to make a mess of things and that they're not sure why this is all happening right now. Either way, there does not appear to be strong support for what the president is trying to do, what acting Secretary Miller is trying to do among senior uniform leadership. And there certainly does not seem to be support among senior congressional leaders, regardless of party. So the question will be is, can they get this done in the 60 some odd days left until they leave office?
There sort of is a sense also, right, tie President Biden's hands, right? Because if he increases troops, then he exposes himself to criticism. Well, there he goes, right? I mean, they're, it's the forever war, and they're increasing the troop presence there. At the end of the day, friends of mine in uniform that I've talked to have sort of seen this in sort of two ways, including those who've served in Iraq and in Afghanistan. On the one hand, it's, you know, failing to actually accomplish anything is just indicates a waste of blood and treasure. On the other hand, there are those who say, hey, look, you know, it's just, let's just get out. You know, it's time to get out. Where do you see people on these two poles, as it were, right? I mean, the Obama administration came under a lot of criticism for getting out of Iraq. You know, that was seen as too precipitous. And then any effort to reduce troop presence and troop numbers, you know, fostered this sort of emotional argument at the end of the day about why we couldn't withdraw. What's the sense you're getting from people at this point?
So largely I hear from my friends and mentors that are still in uniform, you know, across the services, is that it is probably time to bring the conflicts and to an end and get out. The but that they tell me is that there has to be a plan. There has to be some sort of plan that takes into account what was sacrificed, both in terms of time, treasure, and more importantly, lives lost. And there has to be a plan that takes into consideration the sacrifice that our allies have made in addition to our own forces. But, you saw the NATO Secretary General come out against the decision, and you've heard from other allies that talk about how hasty this move is. So I think on the military side, folks are willing to accept that ending this conflict is long overdue, but they're very concerned that we're doing it without a plan and without the buy-in of the people that fought, shoulder to shoulder with us.
Let me ask a cost issue. I was talking to a friend of mine today, and it was echoed by overseas folks who were, debating, okay, well, how do you do this when talking to my overseas friends? How do you do this as quickly as you do? And, isn't it irresponsible? And one of them about a week or so ago had said, well, I mean, it's easy to pull out, Vago. You just fly your guys out and literally dynamite, thermite grenade all the equipment, or just abandon the equipment. And, I was talking to a friend of mine today, a U.S. official, and he said, look, I mean, a large number of equipment will likely be abandoned, and, command posts, and, just installations and things like that will be ceded, which, there is a financial cost associated with that. Is that, fueling any concern on anybody's part? Because at the end of the day, I mean, we paid for all of this stuff. We borrowed money to pay for all of this stuff. Sort of any discussion at all on what happens to the equipment that gets left behind?
I haven't heard any serious concern. I mean, it would come as a shock to me that suddenly now people are worried about how much things right. cost in Iraq and Afghanistan. I will tell you, as a communicator, I think the larger cost would be the imagery and the iconography of what all of that looks like. I mean, think about, and this was, before I was even born, but think about the images of the United States abandoning South Vietnam, and how that still kind of haunts a generation of policymakers and national security officials. Now imagine the Taliban part two, Al-Qaeda part two, ISIS, whoever fills that void. Now imagine them using all of the imagery of the, the U.S. abandoning or hastily leaving Afghanistan, hastily leaving Iraq. I think that's a larger cost. I think that has a longer lingering effect than any fiscal cost may have in the short term.
I remember as a little kid watching that on TV, rather, along with a lot of people, rather astonished. And that was a war for which support evaporated remarkably quickly, and there was a precipitous withdrawal. There are many people who say that, the situation is, don't be an ally of the United States, because at the end of the day, the United States just will pull out and leave you in a lurch. And that's certainly been the concern in Afghanistan as well at the end of the day. Although, critics of the conflict, will criticize the Afghans and say, look, they're not holding up their part of the bargain in this. At the end of the day either, although they would have told you, we're not the ones who asked you to invade us nearly 20 years ago. Chris, thanks very much for joining us. Really appreciate it. And looking forward to a deeper conversation with the team on Friday. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Vaga.
And joining us now is Christopher Cavas, our contributing editor, who has just literally gotten back from a trip aboard USS Gerald R. Ford. Your second trip aboard, Chris, underway. We were underway aboard earlier this year. We flew on and off in a helicopter, whereas you actually took COD Airways, a C-2 Greyhound, truly a legendary airplane. So what was it like traveling Nav Air at a time of COVID? Sort of give us the sense on what some of the precautions were, because you do get a little bit up close and personal when you're cheek by jowl aboard a COD and it's a confined space.
The media embarks that are a feature of regular coverage in the U.S. Navy have been severely cut back this year, like everything else. You were out in January. There was the Navy had planned to have a whole series of media embarks actually throughout the year. Very aggressive effort to get people out there. And that all died died quickly as COVID rose up. So nothing's really happened all year. This was an experiment. It was kind of a one-off. The Navy does not intend to resume this sort of media embarks on any widespread basis at all. But they're trying right now. They were anxious to get people out to see the ship while she's operating. So this has been a very busy year for the Ford. Very busy year. They've been underway for over 200 days this year, which for any ship is a lot, and for a ship that's not deployed is exceptionally high. They're conducting flight operations. The big difference between when you were out in January and I was out last November, a year ago, is that they're now doing flying operations. So they've qualified almost all the operational Navy aircraft that fly from carriers, and they were doing flying operations all the time we were out there. So we were out on the flight deck. We saw a number of launches of F-18 Super Hornets, E's and F's, and a couple E-2D command and control aircraft. And then we watched everybody land, same thing, recoveries. So yes, I've flown on and off carriers as you have many times. You fly in a COD. COD's an interesting experience because it's a cargo aircraft. There's no windows, just two small portholes, but you really can't see anything. You sit backwards. You're essentially cargo. They can actually fit 64 people in these things if they want to pack them in. They're not packing them in these days. They had all you sat. There was nobody next to you. They had the seat pulled down. Actually, obviously, everybody's wearing masks. There are precautions. They take your temperature. No close gathering anywhere, and trying to keep people as spread out as they can.
Give us a sense on what the protocols were aboard the ship, right? So there was temperature taking, skipping seats, but what was it like when you got aboard the ship, right? I mean, that crossed an acting Navy secretary, his job effectively, what happened aboard Teddy Roosevelt. What were some of the precautions that were in effect when you were aboard Ford?
You know, everybody wears a mask all the time. People are trying to stay away, but again, you go down a passageway, a hallway, on any ship is not this. These are not wide hallways. The galley arrangements are interesting. I mean, people don't eat together anymore. They're really broken up. It actually makes some of the efforts to create an esprit de corps more difficult. The commanding officer, Captain J.J. Cummings, was talking about he's got all these new people on board, but he has difficulty getting to know them. It's harder to get to know them when they come in, because one of the best ways to do that is you have dinner together, you eat together.
Right.
You share a meal and get to know each other, and that's not possible. They're not doing that. They're all broken up. There were 200 members from people from Newport News Shipbuilding on board. They're still working on the ship. That Newport News is the prime contractor for the new technology magnetic elevators, and they're working on that. There's one elevator that's still being worked on. A lot of people working on it. There's 200 folks. They actually bring on their own cooks. They stay in their own quarters. They don't share quarters with anybody else. They have their own people making their own food. So there are definitely efforts to try and split things up and minimize contact. But there really is only so much you're going to do on a ship. Obviously, the Navy is sensitive to the COVID. They don't release specific numbers anymore about outbreaks, and they don't necessarily announce them. We know they're still happening, and they acknowledge they're still happening. When people get sick, they are instantly quarantined and they're gotten off their ship as soon as possible.
I remember Yank, when we were aboard, talking about how important it was for him to engage with folks. So that's a very, very consistent message. But, you know, recognizing anybody with masks on also becomes a little bit more of a challenge, right? You've kind of got to recognize people's eye profile more often than not, and other features to know exactly who it is often you're looking at, which is another complicating element. How much progress has been made over the past 9 or 10 months since I was aboard in terms of how many of those elevators are working? Because its mission effectiveness is dependent on whether or not it can move bombs from the bomb bays through these novel armored elevators and get them up onto the flight deck and to the hangar deck.
Right. So they're still working on it. Remains a work in progress, which is exactly what they said a year ago. They are pretty much where they said they would be a year ago. 6 of 11 elevators are fully certified and accepted. They're in the process of finishing the certification on the 7th. They expect to have all of the elevators certified by April, which is where they want it to be. That has been the schedule. Realizing you have the same sets of people moving, working on one, and then they do one, we finish that, and everybody right. else moves on to the next one. So it's not like you can work on 11 on all the ones at the same time. And everyone is different. They're all individual. They're very individual, and maybe people don't necessarily appreciate that. It's not like there's 11 elevators in the building and they're all pretty much the same elevator. They go up, they go down. They do go up, but they have different paths and they have different sizes and they have different configurations. And each one is its own. No two are identical. So that's one of the reasons why it takes so long.
Obviously, people have a tendency of focusing on elevators, but I mean, the ship is actually there to launch air power. I mean, obviously, the elevators are an important piece of that, so I'm not minimizing it. But talk to us a little bit about the experience of riding the electromagnetic catapult, which you did, the electromagnetic aircraft launch system, the EMALS by General Atomics, which is kind of a game-changing capability, a lot of manpower reduction as opposed to over the steam catapults, as well as the new generation of arresting gear that has water drums as opposed to sort of the hydraulic ram with cable and sheaves, which is the way the Navy has historically done it. I know that you've ridden, you've experienced the traditional arresting gear as well as multiple different versions of catapults. You and I are old enough to remember the older catapults that had the bang at the beginning of the stroke, whereas now later steam catapults were at multiple points. But riding, I'm told, the EMALS is very, very different. Give us your impressions on what it was like to recover, what it was like to launch with this new generation technology.
Right. So coming aboard the ship, landing, I didn't really pick up any particular difference whatsoever. I mean, it's just you make a carrier trap, it's a bang. You know, you stop quickly. You still stop quickly on these things. The run out is about the same. The run out meaning from when the hook catches to you slow down and then finally stop. But then there's only so much strain you want to put on the aircraft anyway. But it was smooth. It was okay. It wasn't uniquely different from what I've experienced on other ships. The takeoff was different. The EMALS launch, and I didn't really know what to expect. So it was just like let it play out and let's just think about it afterwards. It seemed overall it was smoother. It just felt smoother all the way around. Started smoother. Was smoother running, and the release was much smoother. And it was actually shorter. So if it's shorter and the run is about the same, then you figure you were going faster. You lifted off easier. The whole thing was definitely different. I mean, truly, there was a noticeable physical difference in how it worked. And like I said, it was smoother. So it's got to be better on the aircraft. It's got to be better on your gear. I don't know how you make a landing much smoother, because a landing is sort of, it is what it is. You're flying, you have to stop.
Yeah. I get your point. In about 350 feet, it is what it is.
We were on the flight deck for over an hour while they were doing flight ops. They launched quite a number of F-18s and a couple E-2s, like I said. Didn't see any particular problems going on anywhere. Things worked out. Occasionally they'd stop to check a sensor or something, but there wasn't didn't seem to be any dramatic problems. Same thing with recovery. It seemed to go pretty well. They've been out flying all year. They've had a number of aircraft. They've had up to 35. The maximum number of aircraft they've had on the ship so far this year has been 35, probably about half of what a full deployed carrier air wing would be flying. But they've had, you know, well over 1,000 people from the air crew on board, from the air wing on board. They have flexed their systems. So people have had to live in those areas, had to use the head facilities, had to use the galley facilities, had to use all these things when you get, you know, 3,000 some odd people on the ship. They won't really stop until early spring, when they're going to begin a series of shock trials. They'll spend 4 months next year on shock trials. They've already actually begun some of the instrumentation necessary for that. So you have to, the ship is filled with sensors, and the shock trial is when you set off actual real live explosions near the ship and measure how the ship dealt with it. And the, the stresses on the ship system and what broke, what didn't break, what moved, things like that. And it's a thousands of sensors get installed throughout the ship. It's a major effort. And that actually has already begun.
And what is the next immediate thing that's going to happen, right? So you mentioned that that's coming up in the spring. Walk us through sort of the major milestones that the Navy's looking at on the ship to have it be like any other fleet asset.
Right. Well, I think they're on a path where they're ramping up most of what they're doing. So while we were out there this week, they are simulating integrated strike operations. So integrated strike operations, other aircraft, other ships. You know, they have a strike group. They have their air warfare commander that's usually on a cruiser, escorting them, and other entities. And they are simulating a lot of that going on. They were doing a straits transit exercise. The other ships were simulated. They were by themselves, but the Navy is able to put these things electronically, other ships, other entities into a program. So we were in the flag command spaces, so the flag tactical command center. This is where the strike group commander, a rear admiral, and his staff come and they fight the ship. They fight the battle from in there. They've got screens up. You've got simulated geography. You have simulated ships. Straits transit is when you're going through a tight place like the Straits of Hormuz. Mm-hmm. You don't have a lot of room to maneuver. So everybody is in a straight line, but you're also very defensive for any threat that may manifest itself. You're under restricted maneuvering. You can't, you know, have a lot of room to maneuver because you're in a strait. So you have to practice for that stuff. They were doing that while we were on board. And that was sort of interesting to see. So they're gradually adding these things on. They had actually the admiral's staff was on board. The commander of the strike group was on board with his staff. They had an air warfare defense commander from a cruiser that's actually in a shipyard right now, USS Gettysburg. The Gettysburg is at BAE Systems in Norfolk being reconditioned to be modernized, to be brought back to service. But she has a full crew, and that's her role, is to protect carrier. So that commanding officer and a detachment from the cruiser were on board the carrier acting as the air warfare commander. So they're adding complexity to these things as they go on, and they are pulsing and pressuring their systems to see where the breakpoints are. So they seem to be making very good progress. This is the impression you get from this program all year long has been pretty positive.
That's terrific. And I know how incredibly hard everybody on the ship are working and folks in the Navy are working as well. And I know that Acting Defense Secretary Chris Miller visited or is visiting, right? There are a whole bunch of distinguished visitors that are visiting the ship. Has he been on the ship yet?
I believe as we speak.
Chris, thanks very, very much for joining us. It's always a pleasure. Very happy. Let me ask you one quick question. First Fleet, give me your quick sense on that. Navy Secretary Ken Braithwaite announcing a new fleet, a First Fleet, or reconstituting the First Fleet and making it an Indian Ocean fleet. I mean, there are some people who are asking, okay, six ships maybe are in that neighborhood. What's your sense? What's the wisdom of this? Is it something that makes sense to you at the end of the day?
So maybe at the end of the day, no. This is Secretary Braithwaite, who has been in the job for only a handful of months and will be out of the job in 2 months. Announced that spoke to the sub-league. Navy sub-league yesterday about his intentions to create a First Fleet. He was lacking in some specifics about exactly where this would be and where the headquarters would be and who would report to what. But essentially, it looks like a Eastern Indian Ocean, Western Pacific entity may be headquartered in Singapore.
Right.
Not clear what Singapore would think about this. Now, he was out there a month ago. He did a swing in Japan and Singapore in October. But this is the first anybody's heard of this. This has not been discussed. It's not been socialized. It's the kind of thing that maybe somebody who was coming into office and beginning a new term might talk about. It's probably not a very good administrative idea to talk about something that would be require an awful lot of work from an awful lot of people when you're going to be leaving in 2 months. And there's no current consensus this is something that's necessary. There are great problems in creating too many command entities in certain areas. Ships transfer to pass through multiple areas of command when they're on deployment, and there are multiple reporting responsibilities. You have to let people know what you're doing. You have to respond to their requirements on all kinds of levels. I was on a destroyer just a few years ago in the Persian Gulf, and the CEO over his desk had a great big piece of like poster board. And he drew this chart of all the people that he had to report to,
Right.
And it was a fabulous chart. There were probably 12, 13, 15 different entities on there. He had all these arrows. And these are not the same thing. Talking to one of these entities has nothing to do with talking to the rest of them. And he had this multiplicity of responsibilities, and he couldn't keep it all straight. And he drew this thing out just to remind him, you know, who is this and what do I have to do? And did I keep everybody informed and all this? Incredibly complex. It's already incredibly complex. Lines of control are a basic element of military operations. And the basic tenet is don't confuse it. Don't make it complicated. And we tried this, there was an experiment just a few years ago with Third Fleet, which is based in San Diego, retaining control of its ships that were operating in the Seventh Fleet area on the other side of the Pacific Ocean, in Seventh Fleet area op areas. And this seemed to be a terrible idea when it was thought up, and it seemed to have been proved out that it was not a very good idea. You just have too many people don't know what everybody is doing all the time. You can't keep everybody up to speed all the time about everything.
Chris, thanks very, very much for joining us. Really appreciate it. Have a very happy Thanksgiving and looking forward to having you back on right after the holiday.
Thanks, Vago. Anytime.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.